This is the Capital City Recap with Michael Cohen on More Compelling Talk Radio, 1320 WILS.
1320 WILS. It's a frosty evening. We are at 17, low of 11 tonight. Tomorrow, high of just 19 and dropping back down to 11. And then Saturday, we get all the way up to 26. That's going to be the high. Partly sunny, though, so we're going to have a little sun, low of 23 for Saturday. Well, Iran is now potentially facing new sanctions as early as tomorrow from the U.S. That's the news. While they're test-firing medium-range ballistic missiles, let's find out why. Dakota Wood with us, Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation. Dakota, it's been a long time. Great to have you on WILS.
Thanks for having me back. I was offline for 3 or 4 months, assisting with the transition.
Yeah, you were busy with the transition team. What was that like, working with the Trump team?
They are a group decidedly in favor of action, making good on campaign promises. So what I find surprising is that everybody is surprised that an elected official is actually doing what he promised to do. So it really has D.C. in a big uproar, and that we'll have to see how that works out.
And what kinds of discussions were you guys having in terms of our defense posture?
Right. So my role and those on the landing team of the Pentagon was basically a survey. What's the current condition? What are the major problems or challenges or things that need to continue? Write all that up so that the incoming Secretary of Defense and the service secretaries kind of know what they're working with. You know, you give them a warm start and some recommended things that would need to take place to be in alignment with President Trump's campaign promises. So it's, I guess the worrying thing was things were as bad as we thought they were and a little bit worse.
Really?
We've got a terrific hole to build out of, and it's going to take a good long while to do that.
What's the biggest weakness of our military right now, then?
I think it's current readiness, and that's where you see Secretary of Defense Mattis really focusing on a supplemental to the fiscal year 17 budget and how he'll build next year's budget. If you've got a small force, which we do, you have to have it ready for action. And unfortunately, about a third of it is at anywhere near acceptable levels of actual operational readiness. You know, stuff is broken. You don't have money to buy the repair parts to get it back into action. Less equipment means fewer people can be trained, so your force doesn't have trained and certified, you know, pilots and tank drivers and those kinds of things.
Some would say we spend a lot of money on the military. Why do we have so many problems, especially with equipment?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you look at, you know, spending of $600 billion, you know, when you count it all up, that's an eye-popping amount of money. But this is a military that covers the globe. I mean, we've got, you know, friends and allies and interests in Europe, the Middle East, Africa, Western Pacific. No other country does that as a globally distributed force, and we're operating anywhere from 3,000 to 8,000 miles from home. So as we've been doing a lot of operations in the Middle East, you rapidly use up the usable life of say, an airplane. You know, you build it for a certain number of hours of flight, and you're churning through that. So even though the pilot is flying the plane, and you're attacking targets of ISIS or Al-Qaeda, all that's good, you then get to a precipice, you know, the edge of a cliff, and the plane just can't be flown anymore. It's just materially exhausted. So we've been using the military up. All the money we're spending is on bombs and fuel and ammunition and those kinds of things. But the baseline force, you know, the ships and planes and tanks are being used up, and we haven't had money to actually keep that up. And then it's just the nature of operations. You know, in a modern-day combat environment where you've got a Russian Cornet anti-tank missile, maybe $10,000 or less, can destroy an M1 Abrams main battle tank that costs $5 million. So there is a technological combat going on out there, and it just takes better equipment, which is inherently more expensive, in order to be able to survive and win on a modern battlefield.
Talking to Dakota Wood with the Heritage Foundation. So if we had to engage with Iran in a military conflict, are we ready to do that right now?
We have a military that can fight and win any single war that I can think of. I mean, you go toe-to-toe with Iran or Russia or somebody, we've got the ability, but you would have to mobilize globally our entire military to be able to do that, especially if it's a sustained operation, you know, more than a few weeks. You go into months or something like that. Mm-hmm. But we don't have anything more than that. So you couldn't, like, say, handle Iran and still have something left to, you know, bump up against the Chinese or the Russians or do anything else that might be occurring. Mm-hmm. And that's what really worries war planners or operational planners these days, is I can handle one, but then my inventory is bare.
Now, why is Iran, I mean, why they know that this is going to get our attention, certainly President mm-hmm. Trump's attention, why are they test firing these medium-range ballistic missiles?
Well, you've got a local audience as well as a global audience. So where Iran has made extraordinary inroads into its influence and presence in Iraq and then extending through into Syria, right? And it's been utilizing Hezbollah and others to really spread Iranian influence throughout that Middle Eastern region. That's the near fight and the most important fight for them. So what is their reputation? What is their influence in the Islamic or the Muslim community? Mm-hmm. And so these really are hey, we're making progress in our weapons development. We're a force to be reckoned with. We're much more powerful and capable than those Saudis down there to the south. And so that's what they're looking at. And
this is a demonstration for the Saudis, essentially? Is that what it is?
It's everybody. It's the Saudis. It's the Iraqis. It's the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria, the Israelis, the Jordanians, United Arab Emirates. So you have this Shia-Sunni contest going on. You have the Persians versus the Arabs. Mm-hmm. If you think back, you know, some centuries going on, those contests are still going.
And how should we respond to what they're up to right now, then?
The U.S. doesn't want to have any other power that can exercise what we call hegemonic control, that they are the dominant influence, especially when a power like Iran has promised to get rid, you know, wipe the map of Israel, you know, dominate the Arabian Peninsula, you know, through its influence and all that. So I think we need to find common cause with the Saudis, the United Arab Emirates, the Bahrainians, Jordan, these other regional powers to box Iran in. Nobody wants to go downtown Tehran or open up a big shooting war, but Iran cannot be allowed to dominate the Persian Gulf, through which a lot of the global oil passes through.
But how do we stop them? So they're firing off these missiles. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're going to potentially put on more sanctions. Is that going to do the trick?
Well, it's one way. I mean, they were back on their heels where they couldn't sell oil on the global market. Very difficult to raise hard cash with the $150 billion that the Obama administration released. They turned right around and did a massive weapons purchase from Russia. So it allows Russia to expand its influence. So I think we have to revisit sanctions. We have to rally our European allies and our Arab allies there on the Arabian Peninsula to show that there is going to be a penalty. First, diplomatic and economic, but also having that real, credible military threat.
So okay, let me ask you about that, because if we do engage militarily, what's the worst thing in terms of our future? What's the worst thing that could happen from that?
The conflict could spill over into Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, a larger Middle Eastern conflict where once you start a war, you have no idea where that's going to go. So it's a risky gambit. But if you don't present some kind of a credible threat that you're willing to follow through with, then people are incentivized to worse behavior. You remember the red line in Syria, right? So if you use chemical weapons, that's a red line for the United States. Bashar al-Assad used chemical weapons against his population in Syria. The United States didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And then he just let loose, you know, barrel bombs and all kinds of mayhem.
So if we started bombing Iranian military targets, how would they respond to that?
Very aggressively. You'd shut down all traffic in the Persian Gulf, so all the tanker traffic going through. They would probably try to expand the war horizontally into the Emirates, into Iraq, maybe up into the Caucasus, although that would really tick off the Russians. So it's a risky gambit. I'm not saying that's the desired path, but if you take that off the table, then there is nothing that really deters them from increasingly bad behavior. So economic first.
What happens? I'm just curious. So let's say they make that move. That escalates it, right? If they block oil passage through the Strait of Hormuz, for example, how quickly do you see us being able to unblock things and deal with them?
Well, yeah, I think, I mean, you could do that pretty quickly. I mean, it's at risk, but the United States military capability, in spite of, you know, the bad report I just gave, really is extraordinary. I mean, the forces we have forward in that region are unmatched by anybody else. I'm just saying we've got a limited amount of that, and their lifespan is rapidly coming to an end.
Because it would be weeks or months, or, I mean, how fast?
I think weeks. I think there's a couple of key points that the Iranians have along the coastline, Keshem Island, et cetera, there in the straits. But you could reduce those. There would be casualties on both sides, you know, clearly. Economically, it would reverberate around the world. You'd see oil prices spike to $200 a barrel, I mean, almost overnight. Mm-hmm. So translate that to $4 or $5 a gallon at the gas pump.
Are they afraid of us, Dakota? Is Iran afraid?
They are if they see a credible United States power center, right? So they were not afraid of the Obama administration at all because it was an administration that just wanted to negotiate over cups of tea, right? If I extend a hand of friendship, I'm betting that you will return the favor. And the Iranians, like the North Koreans, show that that's not the case. They view that as weakness, and it actually emboldens them to push even harder. Yeah. So when you push back against that, like a police department dealing with the organized crime in the city, when you push back, they are going to push back. I mean, there's no getting around that. So it's not a matter of chicken. It's really who shows themselves to be most committed to holding a line. Mm-hmm. And again, without somebody holding a line, you're going to see Iranian influence and militarization and acceleration of their nuclear programs. I mean, that's the real concern, is that this ballistic missile, with the range that it has, you don't build that for conventional purposes. You build that kind of a missile to put a nuclear warhead on. A couple of days ago, they also tested a long-range cruise missile. Limitations on cruise missile development was not part of the nuclear contract. To constrain their program, but they've tested one, and it has an estimated range of 1,000 to 1,500 miles. So you wouldn't have that unless you wanted to put a warhead on it.
Dakota, just a minute here, but tell me this one last thing. When you talk about the likelihood of a conflict, military conflict with Iran, give me a percentage on that.
30%. I don't think it's likely. I think this is going to be a lot of saber rattling, but if the Trump administration holds the line and if it rallies support, I believe Iran will back down. You know, they're afraid of power. Power is the currency in the Middle East. If you come out weak, people take advantage of that. If you come out strong, they respect it and they back down. So it's much less than 50%. I'm, you know, 20%, 25%, 30%, that's a guess, but I'm not saying it's likely by any means, but you have to be prepared for it.
Dakota Woods, Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation, right here on 1320 WILS. Thank you very much, Dakota.
My pleasure.
Yep, it was very enlightening.